Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm David Kern.
I'm Heidi White.
And I'm Tim McIntosh's avatar.
Nice.
We're just going to go with that. That's all the information people are going to get. But Heidi and I are here with Tim McIntosh's avatar to discuss Marilyn Robinson's novel Home. We're here to discuss pages 150 through 200. Sarah Jane Bentley is here with us, but I kind of want to go with Tim McIntosh's avatar, but I don't know how Tim would feel about that. Yeah, Tim wishes. Yeah.
And I'm going to come unstuck when we get to the baseball bit, because Tim would really ace that. And I know nothing about baseball.
I'll believe you.
Are we certain that Tim's good at baseball?
Dave, I mean, he knows things about baseball. He was talking to us about baseball when we recorded the Plays the Thing this week. He told us this whole story and we were like, polite chuckles.
But are we sure that he wasn't reading from Wikipedia page about baseball?
He really seemed into it.
He seemed like he knew what he was talking about. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Wow, you really take the gloves off sometimes, don't you? And just go for it. I like
Me?
It.
When it comes to Tim?
Both
yeah.
Of oh, you.
Yeah.
And baseball.
And baseball, yeah.
Passionate about baseball. It's a whole thing.
And the playoffs are going on right now. And now that I think about it, nope. His team, the Braves, just won their series.
We know.
So, yeah, he should be. I just said series and my phone offered to help me search for something, I guess, because series and Siri are too close. Anyway, we are here to discuss Marilyn Robinson's novel Home. Sarah Jane, you read this whole novel. You read the whole trilogy, although now there's a fourth book, but you read the whole trilogy during the spring, right? Is that correct?
Yeah, during the spring, exactly. That wasn't that long ago. This year has gone so quickly. I was a nursing mother, babe in arms, and I used to settle down with Marilyn Robinson. And I loved the fact that it was about home as well and family. That just seemed really appropriate at the time to be reading this.
Yeah. Did it? We've talked, Heidi and I have talked quite a bit over these first, two or three episodes about the sadness of this book. Heidi's used the word sadness. I've decided that the word should be, my word for it is melancholy.
Fair.
So how did that hit you having a new baby and being a mom and thinking about all the themes that are in this book within that context?
I thought that the novel was elegiac. I thought it was an elegy for something that I probably didn't quite understand, because I've never lived in a small town in kind of the Midwest. But I did read Laura Ingalls Wilder as a child, and I like Steinbeck and stuff. So yeah. I did get a sense, that there's something about loss here. That she's grasping at something that's just slipping away. And I did think there was a lot of hope, though, in the novels because of the resilience of the characters and especially the character of Lila, perhaps not so much Jack, but there's a sense that whatever they've been through, they will endure and something else will come and will happen later. I would say that the novels are like a triptych where they reflect one another and they need to be read together. Or in a more modern metaphor, perhaps they're like a cubist painting where you see these different angles of the characters, not necessarily all blended together, but you get these different reflections. I think Housekeeping is probably the book where she does that best, because she does it all in one novel. But in this trilogy, I love the way that she takes the characters and then views them through all these different angles, rather than changing the narrative perspective in each novel. And I was just thinking about how hard it is to have the perfect family, really, and how little we deserve in terms of blessings when you think about what we've done in the context of our families, and how unkind we can be to one another sometimes. But I think that despite all that, she does show that love can conquer some of those conflicts and deep set kind of that deep set coldness. Now and again, there's some thawing. And that gave me a sense of hope, I think.
What you just said about how unkind we can be to our family is a really interesting point. I was thinking while reading, maybe for the second episode, about how unkind we can be to the people who we love the most. And that seems to be one of those themes that's running through all of her work. So you mentioned this idea of reading them, these novels in conversation with one another. I don't think that's the phrase you used exactly, but
that's a better phrase. Yeah.
We read Gilead a handful of years ago on the show. And one of the reasons I wanted to read this one is because I felt like while it works as an independent story, I think maybe that's a point we disagree on and we can argue about in a future episode or something. I think it really does complete. Well, it doesn't complete. It's that extra perspective helps you understand both home and Gilead. Like it helps complete or further the themes that were in Gilead, and enriches that experience as well. So when you read them, did you read them back to back to back?
Yeah. Slow going because my concentration and sleep was really disrupted. But I did just whenever I had the chance, I was into one of these novels. Yeah.
Yeah. And we'll get into this section a little bit more here in a minute, but I find them to be slow going is an interesting, is probably the right term. They're so sort of precise and carefully written that when I read Marilynne Robinson, let me put it this way. Sometimes you read a novel and it feels like the novel just spilled out of the author. Like there's this energy to it and it probably didn't. It took a lot of work, but some people just have that way of writing that feels like they couldn't help it, right? It was just an overflow. When I read Marilynne Robinson, and I don't mean this as a criticism, there's like a carefulness to it. If she wrote a paragraph a day and that was it, and she labored for 5 hours over one paragraph, I wouldn't be surprised. And I think sometimes that makes you almost have to approach it as a reader that way as well. Which is not to say that it's boring or it's a slog. It's just that because it's so carefully written, it's so easy to miss things. So when you went back and reread this section, did you have a similar experience in reading it you said it was kind of slow going because of your lack of sleep and so forth, but do you think it truly was just lack of sleep, or do you think there's something to the way she writes that also made it a little bit slow going for you?
I just meant that it was slow going in that I had to keep stopping. When I was actually reading the novel, I did read it pretty quickly.
Right.
I thought it was easy to read in that sense, compared to Shakespeare, for example.
Right. To Tolstoy. So,
yeah. I think it's a really layered experience, and that you read the first novel, she suggests and insinuates things, and then in the second novel shifts the perspective a little bit. And then by the third one, you get this really full sort of three-dimensional picture. And I loved how in control she is of where the story's going. And you think it's going one way and then it's not. I was really interested to know more about how she writes as well. And she writes by hand. She doesn't use a typewriter. She says she does all the writing in her head. So she kind of talks through the sentences and then puts them down.
And it doesn't surprise me, actually.
Yeah, she said that's especially true for this novel because so much of it is dialogue, which is quite interesting compared to, say, Housekeeping, which is her sort of flagship one. And so her technique, I think, does make it it can seem quite rambling, although she's obviously got a very... Yeah. Start sort of thought out plot behind it all. And she wrote Gilead really quickly. And then there are these huge gaps between them. So yeah. I think she writes very, very fast, but thinks very, very slow. Perhaps that's what we experience as we read.
That's really interesting. Okay. Here's my last question about the Sarah Jane Bentley, Marilyn Robinson experience before we get into some more general conversation about this section. You mentioned you might not be able to be Tim's avatar during the baseball sections, but you also said that you've read plenty of American fiction, but of course you were not American. Do you find that this book is, as someone who is not American, doesn't live here, do you find this book to be uniquely American in the way that some other American writers' novels are? Or and I don't mean, did you get confused by American stuff? That's not what I mean. But do you find, as an English teacher and someone who reads a lot and is well-read and very knowledgeable, do you find this to be a uniquely American book, do you think?
Thanks for all the flattery in the question.
Well, you know, I always got to ramble.
As I hope.
I got to ramble a little bit to give people time to think. So, you know.
That's really kind. I think that Marilyn Robinson is striving to be an American voice, mm-hmm. and is distilling something about American culture that she loves or has experienced. She said in an interview that she was brought up in a family of women who made pies. And you've been talking in the previous podcast about how important food is and how important it is to set the table and fix the supper. And I think there's a kind of nostalgia there as well for a certain age or atmosphere or tone of American domestic life that perhaps is no more.
Is that a difference from the culture we're in England or in Wales?
Yeah, I think so. Because, I mean, some of the characters go off to Europe, don't they? And then there's a sense that they're sort of lost. Or that happens in Gilead anyway. I think mm-hmm. Ames's brother goes off to Europe. That the churches or the chapels work in the towns as well, I think is quite American. I'm saying American. I mean, America's a massive country. Yeah. It's not the same everywhere. But I think what she's writing about is, it's Iowa, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's what she's trying to capture. So I don't want to be too, I don't want to generalize too much because America's so different all over. But the Congregationalists and the Presbyterians, I think that's something that's very much, that's to do with that particular part of America that I can't really think of an exact parallel for that in England.
Although, didn't you all fight a civil war that was between two different denominations, the whole basis of the civil war, like several centuries ago?
Yes, but I think it's more to do with the...
politics.
It's more to do with the fabric of the town.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah.
Maybe if I'd been brought up in Britain a few decades earlier than I have. Mm. In fact, maybe you're right. I mean, there was always a sense in my family, in previous generations, that something untoward had happened because my mother's father married. And he was a Church of Wales sort of attendee, married someone who went to a Methodist church. My mother's mother was non-denominational, non-conformist. And there was the sense that, like, that shouldn't really cross over. And that kind of lingered through the family. So it's that sort of tension in the town, I think, that I'm picking up on. I don't think that exists so much now in British towns and villages, but... to me, it feels like an American thing.
Hmm. Well, we'll get to baseball later, but Heidi, I'm going to turn over to you now. Now that we've gotten the a little overview of the Sarah Jane Bentley, Marilyn Robinson experience, let's talk about pages 150 through 200. And in this section, we get more conversation where people don't pass each other so much. We talked about how for the first 150 pages of this book, we've got older Boughton, we've got Jack, and we've got Glory, and they're trying to connect, but for the most part, they tend to pass by each other and are not very successful in that. My sense in this section here, 150 through 200, is that they're managing to connect a little bit more in this section. So my first question is, and I'll ask you this first, Heidi and Sarah Jane, jump in whenever you want. Do you agree with that assessment that they're finally able to connect in ways that they were not able to through the first, say, I don't know, half of the novel?
Yes, I do. And I found it really interesting reading this week. I read the section twice. And I really liked this section a lot. I have this very distinct feeling of being led deeper into something as the more that the further we get into the novel. And I was saying before we went on air to you, David, that I'm very grateful that I have never read this novel before. And usually for close reads, it's a reread. But this is a first time read for me. And I feel like I'm grateful for that because I feel like if I had read it before, our conversations would have been very different up to now because I'd have known what Marilynne Robinson was leading us to. And I still don't know, but I have this sense every section, every week of being taken kind of deeper into a house and deeper into a home. Like I'm being invited to open more rooms to like explore and make myself more at home within this kind of mysterious unfolding of these relationships within this family and being led down a corridor of memory, even. She does a really beautiful job of weaving the historical culture and the memory of their home life as children. She does a beautiful job of weaving that into what's going on now. And last week specifically, we talked about sadness, and I was making the case that this home had, like, there wasn't any evidence of real joy, and I made kind of a big deal about that. And then this week I feel like, oh no, this was a really happy family and with lots of like rich memories and traditions, and so I do really have this sense of being led deeper into a home, and a home is a metaphor for the soul, which is a big deal for Robinson, like being taken deeper into the soul of this book and being invited into something, beginning as a stranger and kind of taking this road into more of a relationship with the novel, with the characters. And then that seems to reflect what's going on for the characters. My experience as a reader, in other words, is mirroring kind of that, development, specifically between Glory and Jack. A bond is happening. There's kind of this renewal in their relationship, an increased trust, a confiding, even though they're still both very guarded. So long answer to your question.
Go ahead, Sarah Jane. Were you going to say something?
I just really like that image that Heidi's brought up of a corridor of memory. And that in this section, I always think it's maybe one of the challenges that the Bortons face is, can they bring the family back to life? Everything seems to be dying. And in this section, the garden gets rejuvenated by Jack and they're bearing fruit. And he's this sort of fruitless character. We learn in this section, he's had one daughter who's killed. She wasn't killed. She died. And, there's a kind of hope here that he can bear fruit for the family in some way. He's rebuilt his mother's garden. And then the car also he brings back to life. And it all begins with a sign.
Even brings up Lazarus.
And there's that joke at the dinner table. I love Jack.
I know.
And it just falls flat. But it does seem that he's sort of the walking dead, and he's walking around trying to bring things back to life. And the great fear is obviously that he's going to leave and it's all just going to die again. Mm. And Glory's been trying to revive things too and revive her mother's traditions. And the father is there declining, and inevitably he's going to be at rest soon.
It's really interesting that Robinson, in a way, as readers, she gives us seeds of things to cling to when we're looking for hope. But then she doesn't necessarily make, you know, just as you feel like there's hope in the book, such as with the car, with the Lazarus joke, with the garden bearing fruit, things like that, it doesn't necessarily translate to the next scene in the book being some kind of breakthrough for all the characters.
Right.
So it's realistic in that way. There's a degree of realism that most of the time, having peace with people that you haven't had peace with for a long time, even though you love them, that takes work. That takes time. And sometimes time, the problem here is that they don't have a lot of time, but time is what it takes. But then Robinson then uses these images and metaphors that you're talking about. She incorporates them into the story and she offers us as readers those seeds of hope that suggest to us that there is, just to borrow the colloquialism, a light at the end of the tunnel. I'm mixing my metaphors there, I guess. But it gives us something to cling to when we get back to the scene where they kind of brush past each other and aren't able to connect. And then maybe the next time they do connect, and then the next scene after that, maybe they don't and they're frustrated with each other again. And those peaks and valleys, again, just the metaphors are everywhere here, but these peaks and valleys are frustrating for the reader, but they're also so human. And so when she offers us a return to the garden, it's like we get a moment where Robinson is reminding us that there is hope, that once he finally gets the car to run, once they go out to the garden again, there's cucumbers and they talk about how cucumbers smell like the evening or something like that. Those are like things that they're like, help me use a fifth metaphor here. There's something to grab onto for us as readers, right? They're just kind of a signpost or, you know, a hand, something to grab onto. You know what I'm saying? I'm rambling at this point now, but I got confused by how many metaphors I used. So, you know, that's why they tell you not to mix your metaphors, because that's when right. You keep talking, you just get lost.
That's so true. Case in point.
The corridors just get too intense.
One thing that was comforting about Home is that it really surprised me. I read Gilead and Ames has this sense that the Bortons are really kind of to be revered and that they've got it together and they're this big, successful family. And then I read Home and thought, oh, Ames is wrong. They have their problems as well.
Yeah. And in a way, they revere Ames too. Like Jack is so afraid of what Ames is going to think of him. And you can tell that Boughton has this deep respect for Ames. And Glory talks about how much wisdom Ames has. But he's more congenial or something like that than her father was. And so, you know, even the people who you most sort of revere for what seems like wisdom are not without their foibles and trials, I guess. What were you going to say, Heidi?
Well, I think that Ames... I do think that the novel can stand alone, but I think that Gilead makes it better for sure, especially and particularly with Ames, because what Ames provides, I think, for Home is the outside view of Jack, that this is the perfect family and Jack is the scapegoat, right? He is a scapegoat, but people don't know necessarily that he's a scapegoat. They just think he's the problem child. And Ames has his own complicated relationship with Jack and his own tangled connections with him that Gilead is a lot, it has the element of the blessing that you brought up earlier, Sarah Jane, and both of their feelings about that missed blessing. But I think that Gilead is really helpful for understanding the general perception of this small community about Jack. And I think that helps interpret Home really well. Because the Home is an invitation into that. But Ames provides, even though he's a close to the family, he's not in the family. So he has the outsider view of the family. And that adds a layer of poignancy and pathos, I think, to our own interpretations of the novel.
Can I ask you one of those really pedantic David Kern questions that drives people crazy? You said that that Gilead makes Home better. Mm-hmm. Do you actually believe that Gilead makes Home a better novel, or does Gilead make the reading of Home a better experience?
That's a really good question, and that is a hard question to answer, which I like hard questions to answer. So I don't dislike this pedantic David Kern question, but it is a pedantic question. That's a hard question to answer. I think it makes it better.
You think it actually, like, Gilead actually makes Home a better novel.
I do.
So then, yes. Well, Sarah-Jane, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I agree. It does make it a better novel because of it's part of a structure, isn't it, that mm-hmm. that's been connected to something. It's actually the kind of middle piece of the puzzle. So mm. I think it requires more architecture and skill to have written it in light of the first novel.
Does the Inferno make the Paradiso or Purgatorio better?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do we mean by better?
More complete, perfect in the sense of complete, maybe.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, okay. I'll buy that. All right, we can move on now. Sarah-Jane, the crown molding in your room or study or whatever that is very impressive. And it's the angle of the camera is like, it's probably the kind of crown molding that they would have had in the Boughton's home.
That's not how I picture their home.
That's fair.
That's really interesting. This house used to be where the Queen's physician lived. This is a bit of a sideshow now, but the Queen's doctor used to live here.
That's amazing.
Days gone by. Yeah.
Like,
that's
which,
far
like
from
just
Windsor Castle.
All the Queen's doctors over a period of time lived there, or a specific Queen's particular doctor?
The latter, I think. The Queen's physician.
So yeah. Any number of weird medical things could have occurred in your home.
Yeah, because after that, it was a surgery. It was the local surgery. And it was the sanatorium for all the boys that had eaten for a long time as well. So, yes.
So you've
sure.
seen... Plus
it's
minus
a rich history.
Plus yes. minus 100 ghosts in that room.
Who knows?
There's ghosts everywhere in England. We don't have as many ghosts here.
Yeah, I guess that's kind of what this book is about. So let's get back to it.
I pictured this home in Gilead as a timber frame house with a porch and like a veranda at the front. And this is a very sturdy, thick-walled stone and brick house. Mm. And that's not what I thought about this one.
Right.
This is actually interesting. It was a complete aside that I shouldn't have even brought up, but you know, my mind works in unproductive ways. So let's talk about this though, because for a book that is called Home, she goes into some detail on the house, but not a lot. Like, she doesn't necessarily paint the picture for us that you might get in, you know, other stories that are specifically about the places, at least. I don't think so. So the way that you describe it, that's how you imagine it. How do you imagine it? Do you imagine it the same way? Do you have any differences? Like,
no, like an American version of a Victorian farmhouse is how I picture it, with like lots of gingerbread on it and a big white porch and yeah.
A lot of gingerbread on it. I guess it is that time of year. That's interesting.
What about you?
Well, it's funny because I was sitting outside of our new house. We just moved into our new house yesterday. So when I was reading this morning, I was sitting outside and I was, you know, I just had houses and like new experiences with houses in my brain, I guess, in my imagination. And I was reading the way it would talk about, you remember the scene where they're having dinner when Ames and his family are over?
Oh, yeah.
And Jack is meant to bring in the roast maybe, and then she's supposed to send him in with something else, and she says she's going to bring the condiments or something. And I was thinking about how that means they probably had to go, you know, it was they would have been built in the very separated rooms. Now we knock in, when we get into those old farmhouses, mm-hmm. they knock the walls down. Like, was in the new house we bought, it was an old farmhouse, although not this big, and now it's opened up in the living room into the dining room. But you would have had to go through a doorway. And I was thinking about how that at least tells us that it was probably very separated. All the rooms were very separated, as houses were back then. And I don't know that I necessarily have a very good sense of how big it truly was, but they had a lot of kids, so it must have been at least somewhat big. But that, I found that very interesting, that she doesn't really come out and tell us that all the rooms were divided up, but we get that by the action of the novel. Which in some ways is probably just proof that she's a good writer, because she makes us kind of come to that. Go ahead, Sarah-Jane.
Yeah, and also because it's being told from the perspective of Glory, who knows the house because she was brought up in it. So it would
That's
be sort of
point.
Strange if she was stepping outside of that to describe things. Yeah. Although she does describe things in a slightly critical way, doesn't she? Things that she would like to change but can't. And you discussed that a bit
yeah.
before.
Yeah. But she doesn't describe it in a way that suggests that she recognizes an audience.
Right.
That there's a sort of, you know, there's not a very meta, much meta discourse, if you will, in this book between her and whoever she thinks is listening or whatever.
She's very interesting, Glory, on the topic of houses, because she has this vision of what she might have had as her own house, which I'm sure you'll get onto later. So she does really care about what a home should be. And it's almost like she's never had one of her own and she has to go back to her father's house.
And a big part of this section, of course, is that she kind of describes more about what she went through. And how she had thought, you know, maybe she was going to have a family and a home and that didn't work out. And she hasn't told Jack much of the detail, but the absence of both of their individual families looms over this section a little bit, particularly when Ames, ironically, is the one that does come with the younger wife and the younger child. And he was alone for years and years. And so he's the one that has the most complete family situation, at least as far as the Boughtons can tell. And of course, we know from Gilead how tenuous in some ways Ames's hold on that is. Not that it's going to end, but just that it is going to end because he's old. But just the sort of tension that he has in that newfound family.
Can I ask you both a question about that?
Yes.
Do you find that there's a tension between Ames, Lila, and Jack? As if there might be something, some kind of subtext between Lila and Jack that Marilyn Robinson is implying that Glory doesn't quite realize.
Good question. I noticed the specific moment that in which Jack notices Lila and sees something in her, some kind of connection to the world that he recognizes in himself, and he becomes interested in her, not just as Ames's wife, but as herself.
Yeah, and page 181.
And it's very clear that Ames notices that moment and wonders about it, wonders what it means, which that's what everybody's always wondering about, Jack, right? What does it mean?
Yeah.
You go to church. What does it mean? You want a haircut. What does it mean? What's everything mean? Like the pressure, man.
Yeah. Glory says, please come into the dining room. Jack will help me serve. And then, oh good. Jack said, I was feeling a little at a loss. Then to Lila, he said, no gift for small talk, polite conversation, none at all. Lila smiled. Me neither. She had a soft, slow, comfortable voice that suggested other regions and suggested, too, in its very gentleness, that she knew a good deal more about the world than she would ever let on. Jack looked at her with pleasant interest, with a kind of hopefulness, Glory thought. Clearly, Ames noticed, too. Poor Jack. People watched him, and he knew it. It was partly distrust, but more than that, the man was at once indecipherable and transparent. Of course they watched him. He followed her into the kitchen. He said, maybe I should go change. So that's the first time when it's interesting because I always have read that as a recognition of sort of kindred spirits, you know, people who have been through mm-hmm. things, sort of see that, recognize something in other people who have been through things. And the ironic thing, well, maybe this isn't irony, actually. It's they connect. Like they recognize something in each other because they've been through similar experiences in some way. We don't know what that means yet, but it's clear that they recognize a commonality or something like that. And I suppose the irony is that this is a book that's been waiting for that moment the whole time. We've been waiting for that kind of connection really to happen. And then he seems to have another connection with Robbie as mm-hmm. well. And so he has to go outside of his own family mm-hmm. for that. But I think that Ames's jealousy in that moment is, or not in this moment, but across the rest of what we're going to read and what you find in Gilead, is not necessarily unwarranted. if both of those things can be true. I mean,
okay.
I would say Robinson is not suggesting that there's something more there, but I don't think that she judges Ames for the way that he feels, if that makes sense, or his jealousy. Like, I think it would be weird, honestly, if he's married to this beautiful younger woman and this kind of, and he knows about what her life was like when she was younger, and this sort of mysterious, what's the word, guy who's indecipherable and transparent at the same time, and at least seemingly somewhat handsome. shows up, and they're the same age-ish, and they have much more in common.
Like, they have the same name.
Right, right. If he doesn't, if he's not jealous, then I question the book. It's like, he has to be jealous. It's the only, like, and it doesn't even matter if, like, it doesn't even matter if they actually have a thing there or whatever. I don't remember the phrase, the more eloquent phrase that you put there. Heidi, go ahead. You've got something on the tip of your tongue.
I think that's really insightful, but I think it's another denial to Jack, right? It's another rejection. Even if the rejection is appropriate, which many rejections of Jack are, right? He is just this unforgettable character. Like, you can't encounter Jack without being in some way changed by him if you're a reader who's paying attention, because he has done so many things that have broken trust, right? But he's so, what's the phrase she uses? Something about his like invulnerable frailty. It's something like that, that then he's so guarded. And the reason people have to be guarded is because there's something vulnerable behind the guard, right? Like, that's why people are guarded, is that they're capable of being hurt. And Jack's constantly being hurt. And not all of that hurt has he brought upon himself, certainly not, but much of his actions have broken trust and showed him to be untrustworthy. Mm-hmm. And that's this thing, like, we become then, we as the readers, with this affection that we all develop for him, we become one of the people that wants him to be saved, whether spiritually or just kind of in the redemptive arc of a novel kind of sense. And those are two different things, right? But for Jack, they're the same. We want that for him. We all want that for him. And we feel as helpless as the other characters in bringing that to pass.
Do you think part of that, or one of the ways she manages to accomplish that, is by having a variety of characters along across different age groups in a way? Because right. So you've got Robbie, who's a child. You've got Gloria, who's middle-aged-ish. You've got these older men. You've got Lila, who's somewhere in the middle age range. I don't really know how old she is, actually, off the top of my head. But she's not old.
I don't think she knows either.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, yeah. So, you have all these different ages, which makes... And everybody sort of feels similarly, but then also different about him. I don't know what I'm trying to say
exactly. Except for Ames. He just doesn't like him. And we don't know that except for through Gilead. We don't know that from this novel. So it's probably unfair.
Well, Gloria has, Jack says he doesn't like me.
Yeah, but we're so behind his eyes in Gilead. You can't, there's no way I could interpret him any other way than through that. I don't know how I would interpret Ames in this particular novel without Gilead.
Well, honestly, his dislike for Jack is one of the things that makes him most compelling.
Yeah, it's brilliant. It's like a brilliant way of kind of highlighting the pathos on Jack while by seeing the dislike of him through the eyes of a good man. That's kind of, Marilyn Robinson, how does she do it, right? But you're right. Like, everything always centers on Jack, though. And I think that that's one of those dynamics that is unique to, and I'm going to say something very therapist-y right now, but that's unique to wounded families or dysfunctional families. If there's like some kind of focal point person in a family that takes all of the time and attention and everybody else just accepts that as normal, that's one of the telltale signs of a family that needs some healing. If someone's going to therapy and, all they talk about is their one daughter and they have three other kids, right? Or talk about their mother and there's all these other people in the family. Like that's...
It's a signal?
Yes, it's a signal. It's a sign, that there are other things to pay attention to. And that's why I think that Ames' particular character gives in Gilead gives such another layer of interpretation for this novel. So for our listeners who haven't read Gilead, go out and read Gilead for sure. And I haven't read Lila, so I'm sure it's the same.
That's a treat to come. I always find that Jack
when I met him in this novel, I thought he doesn't seem capable of being as vindictive and malicious as he appears in the first novel. He's so fragile and listless in a way. He doesn't seem to have the kind of motivation that would be necessary. But he obviously had done the things he's accused of, and he's ashamed of them too. I think one of the things I read in this brilliant essay interview in the Paris Review, just an interview with Marilyn Robinson, was she said that with this whole trilogy, the thing that came to her was the characters. She had this voice of John Ames speaking, and she loved the characters so much that she couldn't put them down, and she had to keep going back to them. So it is really a novel about character, people, more than anything else, more than setting or plot, I think.
So, okay, this might seem like a leap of a question, but bear with me and hopefully we'll get it back around to why I asked it. Is this a book about nostalgia?
I don't know. I think nostalgia is necessary and part of an essential element, but I don't know if I think it's a book about it. What do you think, Sarah Jane?
I think I might have suggested that when I started talking about this today with you. I don't know. I think the most nostalgic character is Jack, bizarrely, because perhaps he didn't have as happy a childhood as the other children in the house. He's come back to try and recreate some things, maybe in a way better than they were the first time around. But I don't think all of the characters are nostalgic. I mean, John Ames isn't. The Bortons are. Certainly, Jack is like his father in that the Reverend, it likes to talk about his grandmother, and he likes to talk about what it was like when the children were little. Mm-hmm. And he's a very nostalgic character. But I think because Jack has no future to hope for, all he can do is look back.
Right. Why do you ask that, David? What's on your mind?
Well, I guess in some ways I've kind of always, because there's all these scenes where characters are looking back and telling stories. Because really very little happens in the present. I mean, they eat a meal. They pick something out of the garden. They have a conversation over coffee. Like, there's really not a lot that happens. Most of the actions that drive the novel are things that happened in the past that someone's either having to pay for now or work or have already paid for and are trying to reconcile later. So I was thinking about how often there is a description or a story that's told about when the children were young, or, you know, Belton's grandmother, or playing baseball. You know, this section is in particular, baseball is something that is so driven by nostalgia. It's driven by, you know, record books and stats and stories of great players in the past, and even baseball players themselves. Like, Jack was like, I used to be good at baseball once. Maybe that's going to help me connect with, be one of the ways that I can make peace with Ames, because he was good at baseball too. And you know, when they put the baseball in Robbie's hands, they're all kind of trying to relive, like every athlete does, you know, they're trying to relive their own, I'll use the term glory days when you use it loosely, right? And so there's so much, there's this tone of nostalgia in the book in quite a number of scenes. And I was thinking about how, you know, nostalgia has this idea of like pain or ache, right? And in some ways, I wonder if this is a book that has at its root the ache that comes with nostalgia, but also the sort of the realization that that's an ache that never actually really goes away, because you can't heal an ache that's based on past experiences, because even if you have a new experience, it's never the same experience as the old one. So as you have Jack, you know, Sarah Jane, you mentioned the idea that Jack seems nostalgic and he's trying to recreate the childhood that he never had. And in many ways, he never had it because of his own actions. He can't actually truly recreate that by coming home. And so that the ache of nostalgia, or that comes with looking back, seems to be what makes this novel very universal, because I think that's something that we all recognize to some degree, even if we haven't gone through the same things or had the same sort of ache that Jack has or Boughton has. We all have people that we wish we could reconcile with, I'm sure, or actions that we wish we had done, differently or something like that. So that's kind of what I was thinking about. And I was trying to figure out if Robinson is views these things in the past, like that the stories that they tell, does she view them as, the only way I can think to put it is as good things, just because, again, I have a very unproductive brain. So if, when they're telling these stories about baseball and so forth, it drips with this nostalgia, and like there's this like middle America Norman Rockwell poetry that you imagine, visual poetry that you imagine when they're talking about baseball, right? Or they're talking about the boys throwing apples up on the roof and watching them fall down, and the way all these stories that Glory tells. But are those things meant to be things that are actually to be desired now? Are they things that they should be pursuing now, or are they things that are so fraught that they're not as good as they remember them, and thus we and the characters should be skeptical of these memories?
I really like this question a lot. I think that so nostalgia is the painful longing for home, right? Nostos and alge, like there's this.
Everybody who's watched Mad Men knows the whole.
Right. But I think that there are many novels built upon nostalgia. Some of them work better than others. Some novels that kind of have that really nostalgic sense, I think Wendell Berry's novels do. I actually think Tolkien's novels do, because he's created an imaginative world from his own longing for a home, right? So that has this very strong sense of, the Shire being this place to return to. And that when you go back, you find something there that you don't find when you're out on the road. And I'm probably just reading this wrong, but I'll say out, I never felt that from any of the little stories that they're talking about, because Jack's childhood is so bereft of any joy from those memories. And Glory herself seems very emotionally disconnected from the memories that she's reliving. That's my own interpretation. So I'm really curious to hear if the two of you read it the same way, because David, you said that the baseball memories were dripping with nostalgia. I sense nothing but like this sense of grief that Jack has that he missed all of it. Like, I missed it. My siblings had this happy childhood and I got nothing from it.
Well,
that makes me happy and makes me long to go back. Because I do think with nostalgia, there is inherent within nostalgia a sense of longing to go back, which of course we would say as Christians is going to be redeemed in the kingdom of God when we both return and arrive in the same moment. But I think of nostalgia as having a sense of return, of going back. And I don't think Jack feels like he wants to go back. I think he wants to be healed from wounds. I think he wants to resolve them. I think he wants peace, but I don't think he wants to go back.
So, okay. Sarah Jane, you can answer this in a second, but I want to push back on what she's saying here a little bit, because I think the baseball is, I agree with you in everything but the baseball. Because there's a section earlier in the book where it talks about how the only time that he was playing and he engaged with them and participated was when there was baseball, and that it was like he was able to get outside of himself, and that he was natural, and he was, there was a thoughtlessness about him. And then she describes when he's playing catch with Robbie, that he's like, there's a naturalness. He feels at home in his own skin in the sunshine when he makes, in a way that describes it in a way that was similar to when he was a child. So yeah, I think that's totally why I think the baseball is an essential, and I think it's really smart of her. She could have done basketball, right? She could have done, hockey. They live where there's ice, right? But baseball is this archetypal American. It's baseball and apple pie. We say it all the time, right?
Right.
Sarah Jane, you brought up the pie thing earlier.
Yeah, you're right about the baseball.
So I think that baseball is like this thing that tethers him to the one area, the one place that he did have joy, even if he wouldn't necessarily name it joy, but that there was a sort of peace in those moments when he was on the baseball diamond. So now that I've pushed back against Heidi and convinced her, now you can talk, Sarah Jane.
Do I get to cast the deciding vote on this? Is it nostalgic or not?
Oh, no one ever. This is not a democracy. I think we've decided this week in America that democracy is just a bad idea. So
yeah, we're not doing that anymore.
Yeah, we're done. You might actually have gotten it right all these centuries.
I think the Morels are another moment of joy for Jack from his childhood. And it's a secret joy that he had, it was his, and he won't tell Glory where to go and find them. He keeps it. So there's that. And also the songs around the piano, there's some kind of longing going on there, isn't there?
For all of them.
Yeah. The hymns, he ignites something in Lila as well. They long for us, this Sunday kind of love. The most eerie moment or haunting moment, that's a word you've used before talking about this novel, was when Jack comes downstairs wearing his father's suit. Mm-hmm. And he's a vision of what his young, dapper father was like, but he's a bit too thin. And that's a strange moment, isn't it? Because we see the future and the past and the present all together in that one silhouette of Jack. What did you think of that moment?
Let's read that.
Yeah.
So it's page 180. So it's right before the bit that I read. If one of you want to read it, feel free. Sarah Jane, you brought it up. Well, we'll give you the assignment. 180, I think, it's just when his absence had begun to seem conspicuous and awkward. Is that
you
what you're talking
to.
About?
I have a different...
Oh, man.
Different numbers. Edition, it seems. Sorry.
Do it.
Okay, go ahead, Heidi. I think this is what you're talking about here, and you can read probably to the beginning of the next section, next page, maybe.
Okay, you'll just stop me.
I'll just.
Or signal.
Signal. Okay.
Just when his absence began to seem conspicuous and awkward, when she had gone into the parlor to tell them that Jack would certainly be down in a minute or two, they heard him on the stairs, and then there he was, standing in the doorway. He was dressed in one of his father's fine old dark suits. There was a silence of surprise. He brushed at his shoulder. He said, "The cloth is a little faded. It looks like dust." Then no one spoke until his father said, "I was quite a tall fellow at one time." Jack was wearing one of the creamy shirts she had brought down from the chest in the attic and the blue striped tie, and his hair was parted high and combed straight to the side. He looked very like his father in his prime, except for the marked weariness of his face, his mild and uninnocent expression. Aware of the silence, he smiled and touched the scar beneath his eye. But he would have looked elegant after a decorous and outmoded fashion if he had not been Jack, and if they had not thought, therefore, what does this mean? What might he do next? And there was something moving in the fact that the suit fit him almost perfectly, or would have if he were not quite so thin. He was the measure of the failure of his father's body, and also perhaps a portending of the failure of his own. Keep grading.
We can stop there.
Oh man, that's just, you know how Hemingway says he would spend an entire day writing one paragraph? Like that's worth it a whole day.
"There was a silence of surprise" is a great line because you can kind of skip over it and then you think about it and you can kind of act out this whole moment where no one says anything, but the silence means so much. Okay. So we've got this passage, Sarah Jane, go on with what you were saying there. If you would, I think you asked a question at the end. So I guess at least repeat the question. Cause I forgot.
Oh, it was exactly a very open question. It was just, what do you think about this moment, this silhouette of Jack on the stairs in his father's suit? There's so much about clothes in the novel as well as meals. And what's interesting is the next thing that happens after this dinner party is Glory goes out and buys Jack a set of new clothes. And in this section of the novel also, she irons his shirt with the embroidery on it that Della has put there.
Yeah, I love how... Well, sorry, go ahead. Were you going to say something? He kind of froze for me. Well, I just love how it connects these... she's trying to give him a chance to not have to be viewed just in light of his relationship with his father. And so she's giving him a chance to sort of be his own man. And yet the clothes still don't fit him even when she buys the new clothes. They don't fit him perfectly, but they both are a little proud of how he looks when he finally wears them and he goes over to play baseball. And yet at the same time, she's connecting his past, even though she doesn't know what it is, when she fixes the embroidery. And so these two wardrobe, you've got this, his sister who's trying to give him something to look good in and be comfortable in his future. And then you've got what we're going to find out later is this, you know, other woman that gives him the embroidery. And we're getting hints of that. And so these are being connected through Glory. And I find that so fascinating. It's allowing him, they're both trying to give him an attempt to not just have to wear the sort of haunted clothes of their father's youth. And he says, it's so interesting to me, the way she puts words in her character's mouths, Marilyn Robinson, that is, it's so fascinating because she could have just said it or put it in Glory's mouth. There was the silence of surprise. He brushed at his shoulder as if to get off the dirt, right? And then he says, the cloth is a little faded. It looks like dust. And he says that. She doesn't describe it. But the whole action of this is almost confusing to me because he brushes at his shoulder as if to say, there's dust on it, right? Like he's trying to brush the dust off. And then he says, it looks like dust. So it's as if he was confused thinking there was dust on it. But then he realizes, no, it's just so old that it looks like dust. And then immediately after that, his father, Boughton, is the one who recognizes the sort of dust to dust, ashes to ashes moment that's happening here. Because he says, wow, I used to be more alive than I am now. And so like, the characters themselves are making the connections, not the narrator, not Marilyn Robinson. And so we're brought along in these characters recognizing, well, we're all going to die. And think, you know, the sort of transience of time and youth and all this sort of stuff. And I just love the way she does that through the characters, especially in this book, in a way that forces us as the readers to make the connection instead of saying, I'm the author or I'm the narrator. I have made this connection. You no longer have to make it anymore. And it forces us as the reader to read closely. And I think that there's a genius in that approach that forces the themes of the book to be more personal to us.
Mm-hmm. And Jack is always slightly ashamed, isn't he? Heidi said that he bears this weight of shame on a previous episode. And here's just another moment where everyone's looking at him thinking, wow, he looks great. And he's self-conscious. And he says earlier that he can't go into the church because he feels disreputable and he needs to get his hair cut. And it doesn't matter what Jack does, he can't seem to shake off this fading mortality that is somehow incongruous with this wild spirit that he has that he never quite manages to bring to life.
I agree. Well, and he touches the mark under his eye, right? The mark of Cain that he's always so conscious of, exactly as you're saying, right? He's like drawing attention to himself as marked for shame. And as well as then shielding himself from other people's eyes by creating the barrier that they feel from him internally. He literally creates it by putting his hand to his face all the time, and which is just such a poignant gesture with so many layers of meaning to it. You talked about the layered meaning, Sarah Jane. I found this a really hopeful moment. I mean, it's awkward and misunderstood by everybody.
Like you mean by readers who are reading it?
I mean by the characters themselves. Like he misunderstands their, you know, moment as of their moment of recognition. He understands it as another attempt to shame him or push him out. Like he did something wrong. And they misunderstand, you know, this is the point when Boughton and Ames think he's trying to get away from the meal. And so they're constantly blaming him. And all he's trying to do is find out ways to connect with people sitting at the table. And there's just so much misunderstanding in this scene. But I think that moment of him looking like his father and everybody recognizing it and everybody being moved by it is really hopeful. It's on the spiritual allegory of this novel that the question of whether or not he is the vessel of destruction, which kind of haunts everybody and everything, even himself, that how could he be if he is a mirror of his father, right? Mm. Wearing the clothes of his father and being recognized by the community as the mirror image of his father. And there, I think that there's something really hopeful and beautiful about that and very redemptive about that. And I think Marilynne Robinson then had to write it as everybody missing it, right? Because that's kind of what happens all the time with Jack. People misunderstand him all the time, even himself. But he is always just an image of his father, which has the mortality piece that you pointed out, David, but I think also a spiritually redemptive and hopeful potential to it.
But it also provides an answer, I think, to why Boughton and Jack have missed each other their entire lives.
How so?
Well, I think because there's this idea that if he's the mirror image of his father and he has to live up to his father and the pressure that comes with that from the community, from within the family, then his own inability, his own recognition that he can't do that creates a dissonance and that within him. And then that dissonance becomes a distance between father and son, I think. Mm. I think all fathers and sons have this to some degree. Right. And there's always this sense of like, where am I living up to my father? What are the expectations? And when your father is a public figure, there's that also to some degree as well, especially when it's like this big spiritual public figure who's almost like a father to multiple people. He's a father to the community. And so I think that there's that comes with a sort of pressure that he recognizes that he can't live up to, that then creates a gap or a distance between the father and the son.
Right.
And I think that's part of the pathos at the heart of the novel, that they never were able to create distance. And she's slowly giving, or they were able to create connection and had distance between them. And Robinson is slowly revealing the reasons for that, I think. And this is another moment where she does that. Mm-hmm. Sarah Jane, do you want to say something about this?
I just hadn't before thought about that Ames's expectations of Jack are wrong. I think that was really insightful. I was just mulling that over, that is why they don't connect properly, I think. And also the sense that maybe Jack is supposed to be more like Ames and he gets lost in between these two father figures because he isn't really like either of them.
That's interesting. I don't know that I spent a lot of time thinking about how Ames is sort of a father figure that Jack also isn't managed to live up to. Because sometimes if you might have a guy or I guess it probably happens in mothers and daughters too, but you might have fathers and sons who aren't able to connect, but at least the son can connect with somebody who knows the father or has some kind of connection and can kind of be a go-between. You might have a godfather type of character or an uncle or some other father figure, but he even misses out on that. Well, let me ask a question here before we go. I think we need to talk about this before we move on to the rest of the book. Which character have we spent the most time talking about on this show over the last several weeks?
Jack.
The big J.
And yet, there's another novel coming out called Jack. This is the novel where it's from the perspective of Glory. And yet we spend all our time talking about the other characters in the book. I think that is probably both on purpose by Marilynne Robinson, but I think Glory deserves for us to talk about her. And my only question, the only question I want to put out there is open-ended. Why do we not talk enough about Glory? And what should we look for in the rest of this novel that can help us to focus on her to the degree that she deserves and that the novel seems to be wanting us to spend on, the amount of time that it seems to be wanting us to spend time on her? You know what I'm asking, even if I don't have no idea what the structure of my sentence was supposed to be.
Well, you didn't mix any metaphors that time.
Yeah, well, at least so. I didn't put four metaphors in the same paragraph. Yeah. Sarah Jane, what are your thoughts on Glory and her place in this novel, given that she's our narrator, for goodness sake.
She's inappropriately named for a start, because glory is something that attracts attention and is beautiful and kind of bright and takes the center of the limelight. But Glory doesn't do that. She would rather be in the shadows. She's very quiet. She likes to observe. And most of the dialogue she has with Jack is in her head. It's never explicitly said in direct speech. So we do, as readers, need to make more of an effort to get to know her, because it's very easy to forget that she is our vision in the novel. I think she is pietistic and is hard to know. She's put up a lot of barriers, maybe even more than Jack, possibly. And it's not until later that she starts to reveal what it is that she had hoped for and what she has lost. But you're right, we haven't been attentive enough to Glory, and that's exactly how her whole life was. As was she the youngest child? Is that right?
I think that's right, yeah.
That she kind of was overlooked in some ways. And the thing that always breaks my heart is how easily she cries, and that she has these visible tears on her face, but she's never really able to say what it is that's made her so upset. And everyone just assumes that she's sensitive and needs to get over it.
Yeah, I think this is it's weird. It's just weird how much the book spends time on how much Jack has been through. And she has been through a great deal as well, but it's all a secret. The things Jack has been through, although we don't know the particulars of what he's been through in his recent years, everybody knows he's been through a lot. He was very difficult and so forth. But Glory, because she doesn't have this reputation as being... It's weird that because she doesn't have a reputation of being this sort of bad boy character or whatever, doesn't get as much sympathy either from the readers or from the characters in the novel, as if just because she's keeps to herself, you know?
But without her, this family would fall apart right now. She's really holding it together. And she does have her moment of glory in this section where she gets down the big Bible and swears on it and says, hang on a minute, nobody's listening to me. And she makes them listen. Because she
that's such an important line.
Yeah, she knows things and she knows the truth, but people don't really hear what she has to say very often.
So Glory has, two things come to mind. One is exactly what you said, Sarah Jane, which is she is far more guarded than Jack. I think her walls are much thicker than his.
And he's a guarded person.
He's a guarded person, yes. But he wants to be seen. He's always, the sense I get from Jack is that he's trying to figure out where he can put his weight down all the time, because he wants so badly to connect. With Glory, she has walls up and
she built a moat.
No, it's true. She has built a moat. That's a great image. And the other thing about Glory is I don't think she knows herself. I think she doesn't have a very strong sense of herself. She's continually understanding herself through her connections to other people, right? I think the most poignant little moment about Glory is how sad she was when Grace went away to go get piano training. Do you remember that little moment at the beginning when she's remembering her child? And it's Grace, right? Who goes, she's gifted at piano. And so they send her away to get piano lessons, and she has to go live with somebody else.
She goes to Chicago or St. Louis or something like that.
And there's this real, I can't remember it off the top of my head. Maybe one of our listeners can post it, or I'll try to find it and put it on the Facebook group. There's this phrase that she says, something along the lines of, like, there's no recourse for me. Like, I can't keep my sister. I know I'm going to lose her. Like, then exactly what you just said, David, nobody's listening to me. That is like her, you know how Jack has that sense of shame? I think that Glory feels a sense of lostness, of not knowing who she is, of not having any kind of identity for herself other than what she sees in other people and comparing herself to that, right? She knows who she is because she's not like Jack. She knows who she is because she can't get her sister to stay, who it seems like they had a special bond. So she kind of defines herself by being overlooked, and she's created an identity for that. And so how could then her narrative be self-revelatory? It wouldn't be glory. And Marilynne Robinson has, again, done a masterful job of a craftsman of creating a voice from somebody who doesn't even know what her voice is. And of course she gets lost. There's no, if she didn't, she'd be a different character. And part of our job, as you're pointing out, David, I think is so insightful. Part of our job then is to try to find her in there, to try to locate her and know something about her. And I do hope that in the remaining time in the novel that she has some kind of unraveling, some kind of moment of revelation for the sake of her own salvation, in the sense of in the trajectory of a novel. Because we're always looking for that moment, right? When we identify things in a character that we want to help them, we want something in the novel to do it for us because we can't do it as the reader. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing we want for her.
Yeah, we get so frustrated when it doesn't show up.
Right.
It's not there.
Like, we want her to know who she is. We want her somebody to, I want somebody to see her. You know that story in the Bible about Rahab? No, not Rahab. Hagar. When she's sent away by Sarah and she goes into the wilderness, and then she thinks she's going to lose her child, and then God comes to speak to her, and she calls him Jehovah Rahi, the God who sees me, right? Like that's the thing. I want somebody to see her. I want her to see herself, and I want somebody to see her, not in relation to anybody else, not because she's a good cook, not because she helped Jack or her father, but because she is herself. And that is what I want for her.
There's this, you know how people talk about we should read, or when we read, we can learn empathy. You know, people mm-hmm. talk about that sometimes. I always had a hard time with that. Like I believe it, but I always had a hard time with the way it was presented, because when you talk about that, most of the time I hear it in the context of, well, look, this character here has you find characters who have empathy or don't have empathy. And so it becomes this, you have characters to either model or not model, imitate or not imitate the way they have empathy. But this is the kind of book where the best authors, when they teach you empathy, it forces you as the reader to actually be empathetic. Like it's an exercise, the reading itself, it's not an exercise in presenting models or finding models of empathy, but it's an exercise in being empathetic. Like, and that's like, I think what you were saying, like we have to go discover something about these characters. We have to actually see them. And she's the kind of character where we have to be empathetic to actually see everything there is to see about her. And if we're not empathetic as readers, then we could get to the end of the novel and be like, well, this is a book about home. It's from Gloria's perspective. And Marilynne Robinson didn't even give us they didn't give us enough of her. But is it because Marilynne Robinson doesn't know what she's doing, or because we as readers weren't actually reading closely enough and being actually empathetic in the way that the novel is demanding us to be? Like sometimes one of the terms that authors give us is that there's a degree of empathy we have to have as readers to read the book the way it's supposed to be read. Sarah Jane, you look like you want to say something. Either you're about to very much disagree with me or...
No. I was just thinking back to what Heidi was saying about Jack being the scapegoat. And if Jack is the scapegoat for all the kind of arguments and things that go wrong, it seems like Gloria is the one who carries the burden of all the emotional fallout for that. So she's the one who really grieves and longs for Jack's daughter, who we find out about in this section. And it's Glory really who carries that. And she also clearly carries the sadness of Jack. And she doesn't really say anything about her mother. That's a huge silence in the novel.
Agreed.
And so, and even despite all of that, she's not pathetic. She gets up and does things all the time. She's a safe pair of hands. She's the one who drives the car home when Jack can't handle it.
Is that why we might, maybe we look past her? Because she manages to pick herself up, so to speak. She, you know, and I think this is one of those characteristics of that you often see of strong women in fiction, right? Despite what all the men around them are doing, they're still picking themselves up, brushing their pants off, and, you know, getting to work again. Does that give us sort of an excuse or to overlook her because she's so capable? Whereas Jack and Boughton, to some degree in this novel, they kind of have our sympathy because in some ways they're sort of pathetic. And I don't mean that I don't mean that to denigrate them, but they just are. They need this woman to help them. but we can easily overlook her because she's so capable despite what she's been through.
She specifically talks about that in the beginning when she talks about being how she would have tried to be a minister, but she couldn't, you know, because then only boys were allowed to. And so she has this tacit absorption of the values that surround her, right? She doesn't have this angry questioning. She's the older brother, right? She accepts her role in the family. And as the youngest, she was around during her parents' grief over Jack, when the other kids had moved out.
Mm-hmm.
And that profoundly formed her. She talks specifically about how much that formed her. And she, you know, she found all this comfort in books and she became a teacher. And what do teachers do? They teach empathy. They teach the deep emotion of literature. Like that's to your point of her being kind of the sponge, Sarah Jane, the one who absorbs all of the family grief. Yeah, she does it because that's her temperament. She does it because that's her role in the family. She does it because she's a woman. She does it because she's a girl. And she doesn't question that. She's not rebellious. She doesn't question that. She just absorbs it. And now she's got all these walls up. Now she's, again, the most walled up character.
Hmm. It's a book about
all... I really like her.
It says so much, but it's also... I've been trying to think about, because it's from the perspective of a woman who's dealing with all these men, what is Marilyn Robinson saying about women? Which that's like a super general question, but I'm also, it's just one of those, there's so many things in here to think about from that perspective as well. Mm-hmm. And it made me, that's kind of the thing I'm looking for over these last few chapters that I don't think I thought about in the past, or maybe wasn't capable of thinking about in the past. What is, for a book about men, it's from the perspective of a woman, what is she telling us about women? Which is, again, kind of a silly question in some ways, but also...
Well, maybe that's how her name is actually appropriate, right? Like, is this what it means to be... because she's in every way an ideal feminine kind of for her time, right? She's, yeah. Other than what she's been through, other than, you know, her hidden immorality... Like, she is in every way an ideal. That's why nobody pays attention to her, right? Yeah. She's just doing what she should do. She's
the older
brother.
She has to get the big Bible and slam her, you know, yell to get...
She even sits on the porch and reads her Bible until she feels like it might upset Jack. So she reads something else. And, you know, like, she's so accommodating and delightful and a good cook.
And she's also very good at ironing. Like, she's better than them at almost all of these things, too.
So I think that is one of the purposes of her name for people who are paying attention. Like, she is the glory of woman. Is that what it should mean? Is that what it should be? Is that what it takes? But I do think there's a question mark there.
She's the glory of the man, isn't she?
Mm-hmm. The glory of man.
Yeah, because you're right. She bears it all so patiently. And she's the behind the scenes. She's the kind of main thread that holds it all together. That's exactly right. She's the glory of the men.
But isn't it interesting, though, that the men are her brother and her father, and she had a romantic relationship.
And she's been abandoned, that fell apart. And
She's been abandoned, or that will unravel. But I just find that very interesting that in this book, there's a sort of that the glory of the man part that you guys are talking about there is for the brother and the father.
Yeah,
not a husband,
Which I don't know that means, I'm not making a statement there. I just, It's an interesting way that Merrill Robinson has set this up. Right. And I don't know that I can think of any other examples of something like that. There's lots of stories about, even novels about women who played this role for difficult husbands, difficult lovers, you know, in other, I can think of a handful of them, but I can't think of any that it's with this particular setup, but I'm not as well read as Sarah Jane. We determined that early on in the podcast.
Don't test me on that. There's a sense in this trilogy that Lila is mother and wife and Glory is daughter and sister, maybe.
Hmm. That's interesting. So now we got to figure out how this works out in Jack, in the new novel that came out 2 days ago. How do all these roles shake out?
I know what I would write for that novel, by the way.
Oh, I'm really curious to know.
Wait, how you would have written that novel, or you know what you read about that novel?
No, if I was going to write the novel Jack, I know exactly what it would be about.
Well, save that, because you got to describe that when we get to the end of Home.
So John Ames would die.
Violently, like in a really bloody way?
No. All amicably, old age, he'll go peacefully in the night. I won't say anything about Jack that you haven't found out yet by reading the rest of this novel. He would come back. All of the other stuff would somehow have been cleared up. He would marry Lila, be a father to Robbie, and Gloria would live down the road, and it would be a little bit awkward.
Yeah, fair.
It has to be awkward. But also, it's the Midwest, so it's going to be awkward. It's just like the Midwest way of things. It's just a lot of awkwardness going on. So, because everyone's just kind of passive aggressive.
And then he has to say,
this is a Midwesterner.
Yeah, and he would have to sleep in the house and in the bed where John Ames, his namesake, had been, and it would all be really
Shakespearean.
Crippling. Yeah.
Well, we should probably wrap this up. Heidi, do you have any final thoughts? Or how would you write the novel, Jack?
Oh, I would be a terrible author for the novel, Jack, because I would absolutely save all of them and give them a big giant hug and serve them some pie that they didn't have to make everything better. I wouldn't let them suffer at all. They would spend
a lot of months in therapy and then be fine at the end.
Oh, man. I'd be like, okay, we need to have a big family conference. Here's what you need
Here's
to
your
say.
Binders. Here's the outline for the next 3 days.
Thank you. That's exactly what I would do. I couldn't write that novel. I'm so grateful to Marilyn Robinson for letting, you know, they say about great novelists, like you have to just let your people suffer. And that's why I could never, ever write this novel.
She said their suffering. She said that she didn't think she'd ever be able to write Jack years ago. She said that. And then now here we go. We have Jack. So
she's been sitting on it for a while.
That was a huge surprise for me tonight. I didn't know that this novel was coming out called Jack. I had no idea. So I can't wait. Really?
Yeah. In America, 29th, so 2 days ago. I don't know when it comes out in the UK, maybe even the same. I don't know. But I know a place where people can buy it.
Goldberry Books.
Goldberry Books. I'm coming to your shop one day. I promise.
Mm-hmm. Come. In fact, you should come and we should do a little close reads recording party and people can come from all over and we can do a close reads Goldberry Books crossover
celebration.
Yeah,
we'll be like, if she came from England, you can get here.
Yeah, that's exactly. Exactly. Yeah. If Sarah Jane came over the ocean.
That's right.
Then you can get here from Roanoke, Virginia, or
seriously,
wherever. Colorado Springs, Heidi.
I'll be there. Are you kidding?
Take a wagon train.
Yes. I'm going to ride my horse.
Usually in wagon trains, they walked, but you know, a horse would be fine. Yeah. Well, we should probably wrap this up before we get down a rabbit trail that involves broken axles, snowfall,
bags of gold,
dysentery, and whatever else happened along the way on the wagon trains.
The river.
Yeah. Yep. You're a whole different group of people when you got there. We will be back next week to talk about roughly pages 200 to 250. Sarah Jane, you're coming back, right? You'll join us again, right?
That is a loaded question. There's only one answer to that, which is absolutely.
Like, of course.
Well, you know, we got to make sure. I didn't want to just tell everyone that's listening that you're going to be back before I confirmed with you once again that you'd be here. But thank you for joining us. It's been really fun. As always, when you're on the podcast, it's a great time because you're so well-read. And Heidi, she's Sarah Jane's shaking her head and Heidi's nodding like, yeah, obviously you work at Eaton. Is there any prerequisite for working at Eaton that you actually be well read, or is just that one of those things that Americans who like to read books think about people who work at Eaton?
Oh,
I don't want to make you throw your employer.
There is. It comes with some of the tickets you need, I suppose, to get a job here. Yeah.
Yeah. You got to check all the boxes, and some of those boxes just involve reading certain books.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was
unlike being a podcast
thing.
Host. Yeah. Heidi, what are you going to be looking for? Just give us one sentence. What are you looking for this next section?
See, I'm looking for more of Glory's story. I'm hoping for that.
Okay. Sarah Jane, what's your one sentence thing that you're hoping for, looking for in the next section?
Jack to not be quite as ashamed to achieve something and then not to sort of go back on it. He tends to make some progress and then then it all falls apart again. I'd like to see some kind of sustained development in Jack. Sorry, though, we're meant to be looking at Glory, aren't we? So we'll look at her too.
I think probably those two things may go hand in hand. Like, how does the novel reveal more of Glory while also offering us something sustained progress in Jack? I haven't read the novel from that perspective, but my suspicion is that those two things are going to be intertwined in the structure of the rest of the novel. Well, thanks to everyone who's been listening. Don't forget, you can join the conversation over on Facebook. Head over to Facebook, type in Close Reads Podcast on the search bar, and you'll find that discussion group if you want to join that. If you haven't been part of the conversation for a while, please come back and join. We'd love to have you there. You can also follow us on Instagram at Close Reads Pods. And then there is the newsletter. We have closereads.substack.com to get the link for that. And hopefully we'll send out one of those in the next week or so. That's my goal. But I promise things that, all the time with that newsletter that don't come to fruition, but that's the goal. Don't forget about the Daily Poem, the Plays, the Thing, and all the other great podcasts on the Circe Podcast Network. We have The Weight of Fatherhood, which is out now from Brian Phillips, and that's our new podcast specifically for dads. So we've got lots of great content. Check all that out. Ratings, reviews, subscriptions. We would be grateful if you would participate in all those things to help us continue to grow what we're doing here. And thank you so much for listening. With that, for Sarah Jane Bentley and for Heidi White, I'm David Kern. Thanks so much for listening. And until next time, happy reading.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.